that know me well know that I'm mechanically challenged, so this will just take a minute.
No, it could take longer than that. It could take a lot longer than that.
I used to come over here and work on the campground occasionally, and my church people would watch me try to drive a nail. That's an experience. And I walked into the back of the Talladega Church one night. Albert MacDonald met me, and he said, Brother Snyder, he said, there was a guy over at the campground working this week. He's, what did I tell you?
I'm on
here. Do what? I told you. This is my comedy routine to keep you awake on Sunday afternoon. Albert walked in the back of the church and he said, Preacher, okay. He said, I've been working over at the campground and there's a guy over there that's worse than you are. I said, yes, sir, but it looks like I'm the standard of incompetence. And I am. You can trust me there. How would you like to follow with history lectures what you've just heard? It makes me know that Brother Hedstrom is not Jesus, because he would have saved the best wine to last. Instead, you're going to get me. It rather reminds me of a service I was in up in the New York conference, and the conference treasurer had presented about 30 minutes of just bleak, desperate information about the conference, the balance in the conference treasury. And when he had concluded, and I was to speak after that, and when the treasurer had concluded, my good friend Brian Spangler said, now, brother and sister so-and-so will come and resuscitate this service with a song. If you guys will stay on retainer over there, I need somebody to come and resuscitate this service with a song if we lose control here in a few moments. There is no way to say. You have to be here. Brother Parker's tried to tell you. And I will, with very poor words, try to tell you what it means to a homeboy to be invited to come back and talk to the people that you know and love with all of your heart. And I am very, very honored with this opportunity. I thank the camp board and those who are responsible for this. I understood that Leslie Crawford denies this. But I understood that Leslie Crawford said that they should have Brother Snyder back while he was still able-bodied enough to come. He denies that he said that, but it is a privilege to be back home with you, and I mean that with all of the sincerity that I can bring to you. You folks have loved me and cared for me and for my family, and you are very, 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 very dear to us, very, very important to us, and we thank you for all of your kindness. Thank you for the good offering, for all of your kind words, and for your faithfulness. I was not real sure how this would fly, but I thank you for your willingness to come and to listen. And I hope that something has been said. Lots of material we were not able to cover. I hope that your interest has been aroused. There are a number of books that you can read. There are other fellows who speak in this area that I would encourage you to listen to. Lots of information. One particular field of interest that I would hope some of you would give some consideration to is how our movement relates to the Pentecostal movement. I was in the Philippines. I spent 30, 45 minutes, I suppose, lecturing to them about our relationship to the Pentecostal movement. Very, very important that in this era when the charismatic movement is taking the field, so to speak, that we appreciate who they are and how we relate to them. But thank you for being here on this Sunday afternoon. I pledge myself not to hold you a long, long time. That has no relationship to clocks, calendars, or almanacs. Okay. We will conclude this series of lectures, or studies, sermons. Somebody said whatever that was I was doing. We'll try to conclude it with some thoughts regarding a segment of God's kingdom that you and I have come to know as the conservative holiness movement. Sometimes we hear the word subculture used, and it's usually employed in something of a derisive way. Every group has subcultures. Everybody is a part of a subculture. This is an area of God's kingdom that you and I have been, the Lord has been pleased to bless to our lives. And I have reason, and I believe you have reason, to thank the Lord that He has brought into our world the influences that He has. And so for just a little while this afternoon, we would like to consider where we are today, exactly how we as Bible Methodists got here, and perhaps challenge ourselves just a moment with some thoughts as we wrap this all up. By way of review, 1922, the Methodist Church has largely abandoned her role as the primary responsible party for the spreading of holiness across these lands. And again, that's not to say there were not holiness people in the Methodist Church, but painting with a very broad brush, by 1922 or so, they have pretty much abandoned the field. The National Holiness Association is serving as an umbrella organization, operating camp meetings, sending some missionaries, but the burden for the message has largely fallen to denominations. And we have looked at some of those. It would be the Nazarenes, the Wesleyans, the Pilgrims, and the Free Methodist people. The role of denominations, they were building a formal, institutionalized method for presentation of the gospel. That's not all bad. That's not all bad. But they did invest a lot of money and a lot of time in headquarters and organizational matters, their own missionaries, their own educational institutions, their own periodicals, and they lived somewhat independently of each other. As the years moved along and we came into the era of World War I, World War II, the Great Depression, the rise of communism, you know if you lived through that era that change became very, very much a part of the American sociological scene. The church was affected by those changes, and within the church there came to be conflict. Two schools of thought, perhaps, those that were captured by the idea of ministering to their generation, and in so doing were willing to rethink some things. On the other hand, there were those that were willing to address their generation, but to do so in the context of understood values that they did not believe were for sale. And so the struggle was on how they were going to address and meet their age. It seems to me like one of the greatest challenges that the church has ever faced is how to be in the world, but not of the world. And throughout history, there have been various definitions of what it meant to successfully arrive at what Jesus meant for us to be. We as conservative holiness people are convinced that God has blessed to our hearts and lives an appreciation of what that involves. And that brought tension and that brought conflict. In these four specific denominations, those conflicts came to a head. And during the late 40s and the early 50s, they were times of intense conflict on into the late 50s and the early 60s. Unfortunately, there were misunderstandings. There were some harsh words. There were people of an aggressive nature on either side of the table. And perhaps personalities played in part. But having said that, there were some underlying issues that were more foundational than the mere exchange of ideas. There were some basic concepts that were in contrast to each other. There were some things that were believed, and we did not feel like we could put them up for sale, no matter what the cost might be. And so, it brings us to a time when division must come. And it's not something that we enjoy. It's not something that you find pleasurable. If you do find it pleasurable, there is something badly wrong. Something badly wrong. And yet standing for truth has always been costly. The price is high, not only in terms of dollars, but it's high in terms of relationships. It's a sad, sad moment when the church must deal surgically with the issues of truth as they come to understand it. As we move into that period, we teeter on the brink of extremely difficult times as men and women struggle to come to truth as they understand it. The changes progressing in the mainline holiness churches would begin to come to a head. Now the issues are largely lifestyle issues. Basically at this point, we would have had understanding as relates to, we would have commonality as relates to theology. But at this point, the issues are, how is this holy life going to be lived out? How can we preserve the essence of a separated life, and how will that separated life be demonstrated? It's the symptoms of what is perhaps a deeper problem, but the symptoms were the first matters to draw our attention. And we endeavored to highlight some of those yesterday. There were issues that related to attire, jewelry, entertainment, and the allowance of these on the part of parsonage families, educational institutions, passing these rules on to membership, and how would they relate to new converts. So the issues were, first of all, the general divisions had to do with issues, but it also had to do with church government. Because very, very quickly, as the denominational groups made their changes, then the denominational leaders found it necessary to enforce those rules upon respective conferences. Very, very quickly, very, very quickly, the issues moved on to governmental matters. And so many of the congregations that we're going to, some of at least of the congregations we're going to mention in a few moments, would react not only to the issues, but would react to the government. Now there is a disclaimer before we move into these, an outline of the various groups that come to form the conservative holiness movement. It was in the paper I read to you yesterday from Brother Heron, and I repeat it today. May I add that there are good people and some not so good in both groups. Neither is to be judged by the faults of some of its adherents any more than Christianity is to be judged by the sins of some professing it. Please keep that disclaimer in mind as you listen and as you consider the truth that is before us. Midway into the 1950s, in September of 1955, the Nazarene Church would be the first to feel the division, the schism, the breaking of some fellowships. In September 55, Glenn Griffith held a camp meeting in a rural area between Caldwell and Nampa, Idaho. Griffith had been a district superintendent of the Church of the Nazarene in Colorado and then in the Northwest. He was a strong preacher on holiness. He was a strong preacher on separation from the world. He was just a strong preacher. If you ever heard him, he was a strong... Anybody ever hear him preach his sermon on the gusher? There's a hand or two back there. I was just a boy in college, had no idea what was coming. And this old farm of oil hand from Kansas, he had built a whole allegorical message on what it meant to strike oil. And I was sitting in the choir right behind him. He was taking me with me wherever he wanted me to go. And that afternoon, that evening, he preached his way all the way through the sand. He preached his way through the rock. He cased off the well. And somewhere along around a quarter to nine, he hit oil. And when he did, our hearts hit oil as the old brother preached his way all the way through. I remember hearing him at Huntington one time. He was 80, 85 years old by this time and very, very tottering. If you remember Huntington, we had the bleacher, the balcony that came here, and you could sit in the balcony right up here. I mean, you could just almost hear the guy breathing. You were so close. And they put Griffith up to preach that afternoon, and he was very tottery and very, very slow, and he gripped the pulpit with both hands, and he kind of moved from foot to foot. And then he moved a little further to the right, and then a little further to the left. And then he was out to the edge. And then he was out to the edge, and then the old man was gone. The fire horse had heard the bell one more time. Brother Griffith came to preach in Caldwell, Idaho, deeply troubled about the direction of his denomination. Whatever else you get from what I'm going to say in a little while, the people that precipitated the changes that we're about to outline, I want you to understand they were people of deep conviction. I want you to understand that there was not in the majority of them, I cannot speak for every last one, but I can tell you that the majority of them were deeply troubled and motivated by a heart that wanted to please God more than they wanted anything in the world. Dr. Tidwell, pastor to the Nazarene Church in Chattanooga, somebody said that Griffith had led a movement out. Dr. Tidwell said, I don't know about what he's done, but I can promise you one thing about Griffith. If he made a mistake, it was of the head. It was not of the heart. And I hope that you young people, whatever you may think about the groups that you've met and what you have heard, I want you to know one thing, that these people love God with all of their hearts. And they were motivated by a deep passion for the truth they had come to believe. He preached there. There were a number of people who shared his concerns. The result was an organization that was born called the Bible Missionary Union. In the summer of 1956, there were a number of people in Louisiana that were attracted to come, principally under the leadership of Reverend Elbert Dodd, who was the Nazarene District Superintendent on the Louisiana District. In the summer of 1956, they would meet in Denver. And there they would organize the Bible Missionary Church, and the BMC Church would become the very first of the come-out movements, the readjustment. We'd gone through this 50 years before, back at the turn of the century. Now we're going through it again, 50 years later. The emergence of the Bible Missionary Church in 1955. 1956, a rather vocal minister in western Pennsylvania, a man by the name of W.L. King. He operated a couple periodicals at the time, most of which were protest in nature. And let me just say that at the time we thought they were pretty good things. Some folks changed their minds later. But W.L. King was a Nazarene, very, very concerned over the direction of his church. When the Nazarene Church refused to take a position in the area of television, Brother King drew his group out and formed a large camp there in western Pennsylvania in Finleyville and operated a series of churches. 1959, the Wesleyan Holiness Church. Now, this is a little bit different. Again, the leader is going to be Glenn Griffith. There's a picture of Brother Griffith, as most of us kind of came to know him. But the leader of the Wesleyan Holiness Church would be Glenn Griffith. And this group actually comes out of the Bible Missionary Church. It was a disagreement over the issue of divorce and remarriage primarily. And in Muncie, Indiana, they met and formed the Wesleyan Holiness Church. Brother Griffith was the first general superintendent and remained so until the time of his passing, followed, I think, by Matt Harden. And they continue to operate today, operate a college, I think, at Point Pleasant, and have churches in the Ohio, Michigan area and perhaps in a few other places. 1967. And Brother Going can perhaps correct me if I don't have all of my details correct here. But in 1967, the exodus of the Nazarene Church continues. Now someone asked, why do we have all of these groups? Well, here's the problem. First of all, there are geographical considerations. Second of all, there are chronological considerations. Griffith is a little older than some of these guys. He comes to an understanding first. He leads a group out. The next time, 10 years rolls by, there's another group of men, younger group. They geographically are located in a particular area. They know each other well. It's not that they don't have confidence in the other group, but they have their own issues, and so they bring the group out. This one happens to be in the state of Indiana, and it's revolved around a man by the name of Remus Rehfeldt. Now, of all the men who led come out groups during this time, I think I had heard or knew all of them except Brother Rehfeldt. I never had the privilege of meeting him or hearing him. But he was general, he actually held the highest ranking position in the Mother Church of any of the come out people. Remus Rehfeldt was the general missionary secretary of the Church of the Nazarene, and that was a big time job. That was way up the food chain. And he gave an address in 1960 to the Nazarene General Assembly on the subject, is the cause of conservative holiness at stake? Pretty courageous thing to do. It was not extremely well received. He saw the handwriting on the wall. He resigned his office, became the district superintendent in the Indianapolis district, which was one of the more conservative districts, and endeavored to serve the Lord as he understood it there. There were some pastors on the district that became very concerned about the way things were going. Marvin Powers was pastor of First Nazarene in Newcastle. Amos Hand was in that area, Granville Rogers, Don Hicks. And these four guys said, you know what, we've gone as far as we can go down this road. And they came to Brother Rehfeldt to present their resignations to him, that they felt like they needed to make a change. At which point Brother Rehfeldt said, I will go with you. And together they moved to start the Church of the Bible Covenant. They were formed on the campground of the John T. Hatfield Campground, Cleveland, Indiana, August the 10th, 1967. Around the state, there were a number of ex-pilgrims that had not reoriented themselves, and they too joined the group. Prominent in that group would be probably Leonard Wolfe, the Maoris. They joined the group, and the Church of the Bible Covenant lasted for several years with a great deal of energy. And it is a matter of regret, and it is also a matter for study. Just exactly what went wrong at that point, for at some point there were misunderstandings and disagreements, and that up-and-coming organization dissolved, and the result are a series of organizations, Bible Holiness Group, the Wesleyan Bible Holiness, International Conservative Holiness Association, and Fellowship of Bible Churches. All of these groups they flow out of the Nazarene tradition, bear marks of the Nazarene church, have a lot of the energy of the Nazarene church, but they flow out directly out of the tradition of the Church of the Bible Covenant as opposed to the Church of the Nazarene. The Nazarene Church was probably the largest of the four groups that we have considered, and perhaps suffered some of the largest losses, although the Wesleyans did suffer some losses as well. The Free Methodist Church. There are some Free Methodists, exit Free Methodists here. The Sons are here. Dick Miles is here. The Stettler family have Free Methodist roots. And I would be interested to know from you at some time, this was the denomination that had the fewest and the smallest number of groups that withdrew based upon the criteria that we've talked about. There was one group, there was one conference in the Western Pennsylvania area, led by Brother McCleary. There was a group in Nebraska to which Brother Randall was involved, the Nebraska-Wyoming area, led by Larry Smith's father. The Free Methodist retained the designation bishop, and so it was Bishop McCleary in western Pennsylvania. It was Bishop Smith in the Nebraska area. For a while, they operated independently of each other, and then there came the day when they joined their forces and formed what was known as the what is known as the Evangelical Wesleyan Church, and they continue to exist even to this time. There was a second group called the United Holiness. They were basically in the state of Michigan, operated in the Cedar Springs area. The Coxons were major players there. I think that's where Daryl's fan, the Stetlers, were involved with the come-outers from the Brother Flewelling, maybe Dennis Johnson for who in Michigan and his father. These people were all involved in the United Holiness group. Eventually, again, we regret that there were problems, problems that I don't know a great deal about, but that group ceased to be, later reorganized as the Wesleyan Bible Church, and they are the core of what you and I know as the Great Lakes Conference of the Bible Methodist Connection of Churches. They would have come out of that particular tradition. The third group are the Pilgrim Holiness people. And the first of those groups were the, what we know as the New York Pilgrims. Now this is an interesting study because we told you that in 1922 the Pilgrims joined the as the Binghamton Rescue Mission. They joined the what was known as the International Apostolic Holiness Union, changed its name to Pilgrim Holiness Church right there in 1922. The Pilgrims joined, and they always had the understanding that they were an autonomous conference that had joined at their discretion and could leave at the same discretion. They were players as far as the Pilgrim Holiness Church was concerned. A number of the Wilson family, very prominent in the Pilgrim Church, later in the Wesleyan Church, came out of the New York Pilgrim Conference. But as changes began to come and circumstances began to alter themselves, the New York Pilgrims said, you know, we would like to be independent. We'd like to exercise our autonomous privileges, withdraw our conference, and go our own way. At which point the denomination said, we're sorry, but you cannot do that. You have pledged yourselves to us, and you're going to have to operate under the strictures of the discipline. The result was that the New York people voted to withdraw. That brought on a little more talk, and Brother Whitney was invited to come to Indianapolis, which was headquarters. Now, have a picture of Brother Whitney here. That would be him right there. And I have one with a, that would be him right there. The young boy there, I'll talk to you about a little bit later. Brother Whitney was the conference president. He was invited to Indianapolis and he was asked if he was willing to serve under the restraints of the discipline. He said to them that based upon his conscience, he did not feel like he could follow the changes that had been made. And, when he replied that he could not, he was removed from office on February the 14th, 1963. Now let me just pause here to say, as Bible Methodist people, we are autonomous local churches. And once in a while, there may be a little restlessness about that. Maybe more than a little restlessness about that. And I'm not standing up here to decide what is right or what is wrong, but I am standing here to tell you that one of the things that history does for us is it tells us how we got here. And there were matters just like this that occasioned our forebears, right or wrong, to implement a form of government that we have. Because here's a case where people had strong convictions. They paid their bills, they paid the tithe, they built the churches. But they go to headquarters, headquarters says this is the way you're going to do, we don't feel like we should do. Fine, you can go someplace else. Well, we have a leader, sorry, we'll remove your leader. That's not the only time that happened. These are some of the reasons why. Is there middle ground? Wise men will have to decide that. But these are some of the reasons why we are where we are today. Whitney was removed February 14th on Valentine's present, 1963. Shortly after, there were negotiations between the New York Pilgrims and their denominational headquarters. And at long last, without the necessity of courtroom confrontation, there was an agreement worked out. And they were able to retain their campgrounds and their churches. And today are primary players in the movement that you and I know as the Conservative Holiness Movement. Just for interest's sake, that's Fred McCulley. That's O.L. Fay. That would be Rowan Fay's father, who was the president of the conference back in the years past. Brother Whitney, I think that's Brother LeCates, and I think that is Billy Bidwell, and I'm not sure who that is right there. Somebody knows. I'd be happy for you to tell me. The New York Pilgrims were the largest segment of the Pilgrim Holiness Church that chose not to go along with either the directional changes in the Pilgrim Church or the merge with the Wesleyan Church that had come to be an issue at that time. There was a second group that you and I have come to know as the Midwest Pilgrims. Now, they have since called themselves the Pilgrim Holiness Church because the New York people call themselves the New York Pilgrims. So the Midwest boys call themselves the Pilgrim Holiness Church. But we affectionately knew them as the Midwest Pilgrims, and that's kind of what they still are in our minds. But not as cohesive. There were just a handful of young men. And if you want to know how young they were, that's their conference president right there. That's Jim Sutherland. I think Brother Sutherland was about 27 years old at the time he was elevated to a position of conference leadership. We'll move on to another picture from the Midwest Pilgrims. That's again Brother Sutherland. That's Eugene Gray. That's Marion Brown, James Sneed, Ed Shimaley. And I'm not sure, that may be Mark Lemon, but I'm not sure who that is right there. They were early on associated with the New York Pilgrims, and that's the reason why you see Whitney and Sutherland together there. But there were discussions, and those discussions were not fruitful in terms of union, and the result was that the Midwest boys began to operate their own and have slowly drawn churches into the group. With Brother Parker, I had the privilege of being there with a summer group from the school just a week or so ago, and they were worshiping at the Frankfort Pilgrim Campground, and there were some excited people. Some very excited people, because way, way back there in their past, C.C. Brown bought that property when he was a part of the of a group from the out in a Christian Recruit church out in Pennsylvania. They had joined the Pilgrims. That property belonged to the Pilgrim. Rusty Rundell said, "My mom and dad met here on these grounds in 1943. Joe Smith's daddy, Lewis Smith, he's no young man anymore, but about the first or second night of camp meeting, he just took a loop around the tabernacle. He said he just did it on general principles, hadn't been able to do it for a long, long time." The Midwest people are contemplating the purchase of that ground, but it was an excellent congregation, a number of fine people there and fine churches, and they represent the New York Pilgrims, the Midwest Pilgrims, represent the organizational remnants of those that withdrew from the Pilgrim Holiness Church. And that brings us to the Wesleyan Church. There were a series of groups that came from there. First of all, in 1968 was the Allegheny Conference. Allegheny Conference was one of the original six. They were a large conference. Their giving to missions was a very significant portion of the budget, for the Wesleyan Church. During these problematic years, they were led by the venerable H.C. Van Warmer. How many of you ever got to hear Brother Van Warmer preach? Well, there's several of you. I only heard him once. I regret that I could not have heard him more. He was a unique appearing man, and I'll never forget General Conference of 1963. And you have to understand, I've been a kind of a nerd for a long time, and those conference things really intrigued me. And so we went to conference, the General Conference that year, and I would go up to the old Fairmount Tabernacle. All the General Conference delegates wore little badges. And I knew about where the Allegheny delegation sat. They sat right next to the Tennessee delegation where our conference was. So I would run up there and I would look at the Allegheny guys because I told you the Holy Trinity was Allegheny, Van Warmer, and Stoneboro. That's what it was, at least at our house. And so I would run up there to the side of the tabernacle and look in under the overhang there, and I would pick out a man that looked distinguished and professorial and leadership type. And then when they'd take a break, I'd run alongside him and look up his badge, see if I'd picked out the right guy, and I never did get it. Brother Van Warmer didn't necessarily look like a leader, but he was a leader. A very intelligent man, a 4.0, I understand, at Houghton College, and a man who loved God passionately. He was the leader of the Allegheny Conference, and they eventually would be charges placed against them by the Wesleyan Church that they were, what was the word that were used? Insubordinate. And the result was that the conference chose to withdraw, taking the majority of their conference with them. There were some churches that did not go, but the Allegheny Conference was the major, was a large withdrawing influence from the Wesley Church. The Tennessee Conference, the leadership of David Denton, they were a mission conference. They were very small at the time, probably 20 churches or so. Brother Denton was a very energetic leader, took very strong positions. And as a mission conference, we're in a slightly different relationship to the Wesleyan Church than would Allegheny or Ohio or Alabama. Eventually, at that same general conference, 1968, charges were brought against 1967. I'm sorry, 1967. Charges were brought against the Allegheny Conference. Charges were brought against the Tennessee Conference. And as the result of that fact is, the Tennessee delegates didn't even go. They simply voted out and organized the Tennessee Bible Methodists. And some of you are going to wonder why they're Bible Methodists and we're Bible Methodists. And if you'll just hold that question, I'll come back to it in just a minute. All right? And that brings us to something that is rather important to us, I suppose. And that would be our own group. The Bible Methodist Connection of Churches as we know it. Now, I've said that the withdrawal was 1970. That's not exactly accurate. But that date represents our first general conference when Ohio and Alabama joined together and formed the Bible Methodist Connection of Churches. Prior to that time, the story somewhat begins in the state of Ohio, where a young God's Bible School ministerial minister, pastor, Edsel Troughton, had become extremely troubled over the direction of things. And if you know Brother Troughton, you can maybe appreciate this. A man that I have the deepest respect for. He presented a document. Now, it would take me a little while to read this. It's vintage Edsel Troughton. The Manifesto and Constitution of the Society for the Preservation of Primitive Wesleyan Methodism. That's a little hard to get on the front page, on the cover of the discipline. I'm glad they changed that. I'd like to have a copy of it. If anybody has a copy. Brother Troughton says he has one, but he hadn't been forthcoming with it. You have one? Beautiful. I'd love to see it. This was the original document. Troughton had become very, very appreciative of Chester Tulga's book, The Case for the Independent Local Church. Tulga was a conservative Baptist, and Brother Troughton read the little book, just a little pamphlet. He read it. He liked what he saw, particularly in the face of encroaching central government. And so he prepared this manifesto. It was again to be a reform movement. He was in the Wesleyan Methodist Conference in Ohio, and the conference president was none less than our own Leslie Wilcox. Brother Trouton took the manifesto to Brother Wilcox and showed it to him. And a little time passed away, and then Brother Wilcox and he had another conversation, and Brother Trouton said, as he remembered the telephone conversation, it went something like this: "If after further careful and prayerful consideration you feel that you are strongly committed to the support of this manifesto," then Brother Wilcox said, "I would probably want to recommend to you that you make plans to withdraw from the Wesleyan Methodist Church, because this is never going to happen." And that doesn't mean that Brother Wilcox was yay or nay on the matter. It doesn't mean that he was schematic in any way. He just said, look, if this is what your dreams are, it's not going to happen. And so on June the 7th, 1966, there were succeeding pastors from the Ohio Conference who met with President Wilcox. And on June the 9th of 1966, they adopted the name, the Wesleyan Connection of Churches. And I do have some minutes of the meetings of that early Ohio gathering. Now, here in home in Alabama, things were a little troubled. There were influences flowing that we were not happy with. We were in the area with Central College, and some of the things that we were concerned about were represented there. And some of you were troubled over the direction that things were going. And so, the very first minutes, and I hope that all of you have seen this so that it's not new information, but the copy of the very first minutes of the Alabama Conference identifies the problematic issues. So I'm not making them up. It's right there in our own documents. Number one, the wearing of the wedding band by members of the church. That's the number one thing that's mentioned. Now, I hope that you were observant yesterday. I read through some of that material very rapidly. Did you notice that in every group that I read, the cutting issue was the wedding ring? I give that for you to think about. For the Alabama Conference, in our own conference minutes, that's the first issue that is mentioned. Secondly, is television ownership and viewing by laymen and ministers. That's our conference minutes. Number three, were worldly trends in the colleges, speaking specifically of the Wesleyan colleges of which we were a part. Number four is an issue that's somewhat removed from us now, and it would probably be difficult for you to appreciate how sensitive it was at the time, but opposition to connection with the National Council of Churches. Now, that was significant because the National Council of Churches produced the Sunday school outlines that the denomination was using as the basis for Sunday school literature. And so at that point, Brother Denton was one of the very first evangelists of truth to begin to provide Sunday school literature, because we did not want to use Sunday school literature based upon that which was built upon the National Council of Churches. Put it in its context, those are the 60s. Heavy concern about communist influence. Communists were known to be a part of the World Council of Churches, influencing the National Council of Churches. That issue seems a long, long ways away from us, but it is a big thing in the mid-60s. And number five was the opposition to the trend in central government. The Pilgrim Hole, the merge with the Pilgrim Hole in his church became the catalyst, but these issues are all simmering. Eventually, negotiations would be held with the church. And I'm very, very proud to say, though I was not a part of this conference at the time, I'm very proud to say that even those who were a part of the other side in the negotiations for our separation point to the attitude and the choices and the words and the interchange with Brother Agin and our conference. They point to it as if it's going to have to happen, there's the way to do it. And I don't know. I guess we can be sanctified proud, can't we? You know, there's something, when you get people in a fighting mentality, it's hard to get them out. Even for good things. And thank God that we were spared that militancy. Not that we didn't believe what we believed, but we were spared that militancy that just sort of makes you feel like everybody's stealing your lunch, and ultimately disrupts the unity even after you've left. Some of those groups that became so militant about it, when they got the freedom that they thought they want, couldn't get along with themselves. And part of that is bred by a militancy that we can engender within ourselves. Thank the Lord for the leadership which we had. I know that all of you will appreciate the influence and the steady hand that Brother Agin provided. How many of you thought he would live forever? A lot of us thought he would live forever. Even when he was in a weakened condition, we just knew that, and yet God has been pleased to take it. But the legacy is ours today. We are the length and shadow, as our conference, of this man who showed us and helped to direct the ship of state for the Alabama Conference. In 1970, the Ohio, after some negotiations, and interestingly enough, there were negotiations between Alabama, Ohio, Tennessee, and Allegheny. My father was a representative of the Tennessee Conference. Maybe some of you guys were. Alvin, were you there from Alabama? And we can only wonder and dream what would have happened. The Allegheny people had priorities that they felt like they needed to attend to. And at that point, there was Alabama, Tennessee, and Ohio. And the proceedings moved far enough along that the Tennessee people had gone ahead and taken the name Bible Methodist. And I was a boy in Tennessee at the time and remember very well when it happened. After they had voted to accept the name Bible Methodist, there was what can, I think, be called an exchange of misinformation. Brother Agin told me this. Maybe he won't hold it against me. But there was it was misinformation. That's the best way I know to put it, between us, the Alabama people, and the Tennessee people. And Brother Denton drew some conclusions that he would later find out weren't exactly like he had come to understand them to be, but it would be too late then. And the result was that they opted not to be a part of the connection of churches that we know. Though they did retain the name. And so if you've ever been asked why they have it like we do, that's in a simplistic way to explain it. In 1986, the group that I referenced earlier from Michigan joined with us right here on these very grounds and formed the Great Lakes Conference. And so the three of those conferences together form the third of the seceding groups from the Wesleyan Methodist Church. It's extremely important that we understand that this becomes our world. We know it as the Conservative Holiness Movement. Today, we operate as the Conservative Holiness Movement under the umbrella organization of the Interchurch Holiness Convention. And Brother Sankey, who we were so happy to have with us, is the general chairman. Now, that's an umbrella organization. You understand what that means? It has no official response. It has no power. It's the point of reference. It's the place we go for encouragement to interact with other groups. And if you want to think about the Conservative Holiness Movement and try to define it, you can usually define it by its relationship to the Interchurch Holiness Convention, give or take a little. Okay? There's always variables there, but in a very broad brush, generally speaking, the Interchurch Holiness Convention provides the framework that the Conservative Holiness Movement operates from. If you don't believe that, just go to convention and hear the buzz of interchange of ideas and committees and all of that kind of stuff that goes on. And I for one, hey, it's not perfect, And if it was perfect, I wouldn't want to be a part of it because it wouldn't be perfect then. Speaking of it, it may not, I think I saw you there. That may be a reason that it's not perfect. I'm not sure. It's not perfect, but it has been a means of grace over these 50 years and continues to minister to us. Now, let's establish the constituency of this conservative holiness movement, and I know as you look at that list, you're going to know that I left somebody out, and I'd be very, very happy to have the additions that you would bring. But the groups that I've just gone through, the groups that are what we call the come-outers, in addition to Church of God Holiness, God's Missionary Church, the Lower Light Church, National Association of Holiness Churches, the Wesleyan Tabernacle Association, the Pilgrim Nazarenes, the Bible Holiness Church, or what used to be known as the Fire Baptized Church, these churches, some that you're thinking of, and a host of independent churches form the constituency of this group that you and I have come to know. Education is provided through at least 7 institutions. I'm sure I have left one out, and I'm sure that you will remind me of it at the close of the session. But Allegheny Wesleyan, Faith Bible School, God's Bible School, these are in alphabetical order, just so that you know. There are other orders of priority that we could put there, but I chose alphabetical. Allegheny Wesleyan, Faith Bible School, God's Bible School, Hope Sound Bible College, Kansas City College and Bible School, Penview Bible Institute, and Union Bible College. We are also blessed with missions organizations. Remember that those mother churches that we left were established as far as these things. They already had schools. They already had periodicals. They already had mission groups. And we had to somewhat reinvent the wheel. And so we're still in the process of doing that. But we have missions organizations. Most of the denominations that we mentioned have their own mission groups. Evangelistic Faith Mission serves the greater group. Hope International Mission serves the greater group. Evangelical Wesleyan, and again, I'm sure that I have left some out. But you get the idea. Under the umbrella, enter this constituency that we are a part of, the conservative holiness movement. Camp meetings that were a part of the old holiness crowd is still very much a part of our group. Most denominations, if not all of them, have denominational camps. And I've chosen Clinton Ramsey and Kansas State. They are only representative of multiplied hundreds of camp meetings that are dot this country. If you don't believe that, get the God's Revivalist and look at that list that they publish every year. If you don't believe that, get in a van that represents a Bible school and you will find places that you did not know existed on the face of the earth. I'm thinking of one right now. That you get in the car and you drive and then you go and you turn left and then you drive and then you turn right. The roads are getting increasingly smaller as you go and you go to the end, absolute end of that road, and then you turn into a little road that disappears down under a grove of trees, and what should your wondering eyes should appear but an old tabernacle that looks as though it's 100 years old, and guess what? It is. There are many, many, many of these across the country. And there are those who feel like they've served their day and they're outmoded, and perhaps there are some who have served their day. But the idea of camp meeting is still a blessed one, though we've kind of changed the venue here. When this tabernacle was built, my daughter called Brother Hestrom and said, "Brother Hestrom, what in the world are you doing? You're tearing down the ancient landmarks. Don't you know that a person cannot find God without sweat in their eyes and dirt daubers in their ears? Don't you know you can't do it?" Well, we've changed the venues a bit, and I don't see anybody that's crying about it. But the camp meetings continue to be a basis, not only denominational camps, but interdenominational camps that bring our people together. Now, let's look at the holiness movement at large. The first thing I want to say to you is that the burden of carrying the message of a clean heart is not exclusively the property of people who believe the Wesleyan understanding of a sanctified heart. I want to say that right from the get-go. Most every denomination that you can think of will have people whose hearts are open to God and to His will and to His Word. And for that reason, you and I can never feel like holiness is our monopoly or our own personal possession. We can never think that just because people don't wear our brand and bear our stripe that, well, as I used to have a book customer, and the first thing he would ask me when he saw a book on the list, he'd say, is he wholeness? And if I didn't say he was wholeness, he wouldn't buy it. Well, there were people like D.L. Moody and A.B. Simpson and others who did not totally agree with us on every detail of theology. And so I want you to be careful. Let's don't become provincial. Let's don't become so protective and build our walls so high that we think we're the only ones, because God's always had a people and God's always going to have a people. But that being said, it has pleased the Lord, as I hope you've seen through the flow of history, to bless to Mr. Wesley the recovering of the emphasis upon secondness, which produces a holy heart. And we move in the legacy of Mr. Wesley. So let's look at the holiness movement that has come to appreciate the matter of secondness. The Methodist Church has largely abandoned the doctrine. The National Holiness Association is virtually extinct. The mainline holiness churches, and I say this carefully, they maintain the doctrine with less emphasis. And some of you might feel like that's not strong enough, but I'll leave it there. They maintain the doctrine with less emphasis on lifestyle issues. The conservative holiness churches endeavoring to maintain both the doctrine and the lifestyle emphasis. It's been 50 years now since the Bible Missionary Church took the first step. Perhaps we need to stop and ask ourselves some questions. I believe the scriptures would allow that, for he said, examine yourselves. I believe Mr. Wesley would allow that because he gave us the class meeting where we would ask ourselves some questions. So let's do it. What is our understanding of God's call to holiness or purity of heart? Where are we today? What do we understand it to be? Personally? And collectively. How does this understanding affect your lifestyle? It's one thing to talk about those people back there in the 50s who we say made mistakes. But how does this understanding of a holy heart affect your life? How does this matter of being separate from the world affect the choices that you make? You see, we have to pass this torch. If it's going to be passed. And you can't usually skip a generation. So we need to ask ourselves, what does holiness mean to us? Is it important? Is it something to hold on to? Is it something that we should preach? Is it something we should testify to? Is it something that's important that we believe? Secondly, how does this relationship with the Lord affect our lifestyle? Not just theirs, ours. What is our relationship to our past? As we reflect upon what we have been given. But how does it relate to our present? What are we doing to translate that message to our generation, whether it be in our homes or in our communities? How can this message be relevant where I live? What can I do to see to it that this message is alive and well? It's my trust. It's your responsibility. Who will be the proponents of this message in a new generation, in a new century? Conclusion. We have a heritage for which we can be thankful. I hope you've been able to see that this week. I've done my very, very best to portray it to you. I hope that you know that we have, for all the warts and wrinkles, and every tradition has them, I hope that you have come to appreciate the godly men and the holy concepts that undergird who we are and what we're about. We have a heritage of holiness for which we are thankful. We have a responsibility to reflect this holy God to our culture. Let us know a holy heart. Let us live a holy life. Let us evangelize the world for a holy heaven. This is the legacy that we under God have received. This is the trust we must both preserve as a historical testament and present as a present dynamic. In maintaining this balance, the strategic balance between historical treatment and present dynamic, if we maintain that balance and we do it well, we will write new and glorious chapters for the history of the holiness movement. May God bless this tradition to all of our lives. May He make us faithful adherents, proponents, and representatives. And may its truth ever live as the result of God's grace in our hearts and our choices to present its message to those who follow. Thank you so very, very much for listening to me this week. I know I've thrown a lot of information your way. You've listened very graciously and very kindly. Let's stand together.